You're listening to the Courageous Life Podcast, helping you develop courage and resilience in a perilous and unpredictable world. This is your host, Sean Mitzel. I'm coming to you from the mountains of northern Idaho. I'm glad you're with us. Today, I interview Stefan Sobkowiak. He is a permaculture teacher, trainer, mentor, designer, and farmer, while remaining committed to his personal roles as a husband and father. He is trained as a wildlife biologist with a master's in animal behavior. He lectured at McGill University, where he taught fruit production, landscape, plants, and design. That turned him into a passionate speaker, and he's captivated audiences in more than 400 presentations since 1988. A desire to make his words come true led him to purchase a 12-acre orchard in 1992. He transitioned that property to a certified organic monoculture apple orchard. In 2007, he redesigned and replanted part of that property as a high biodiversity permaculture orchard. The result has recently been documented in an educational film called The Permaculture Orchard, Beyond Organic, where his ongoing permaculture project, Miracle Farms, is chronicled. His farm is a members-only U-Pick permaculture orchard with 100 cultivars of apples, 16 cultivars of pear, 3 cultivars of plums, and 6 cultivars of cherry with untold numbers of other perennial and annual plantings, all on 5 hectares, or about 12 acres. His goal is to restore the wow factor to foods, and in the grassy lanes between the trees, he raises chickens, turkeys, guinea fowl, ducks, and geese, all in mobile pens, making for a truly integrated permaculture system. All right. Hey, thanks for being with us. We really appreciate it. Would you just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in permaculture?
Yeah, permaculture started basically was more like discovering what I already had a good idea about. It wasn't like permaculture was completely new to me. My background's in wildlife biology and landscape architecture and landscape design gave me certainly a very good look at all the basics that are then used in permaculture.
Okay.
And that was just basically a start. Actually, when I came across Mollison's book, I was the first one, probably 1990 or 1989. It wasn't so much, this is all amazing. It was more like, oh, wow, look at that. Somebody's put it all into a book. That's great. So it wasn't so much totally new as good to know that somebody's actually put it all together.
Well, excellent. That's really interesting to hear. And can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing up there as far as, you know, when you got on site and what was going on when you got there?
Yeah, for the farm, when we got there, it was a 4,000 tree dwarf apple orchard. So that's what was there when we got there. And so then we didn't want to do any of the spray. It had been like that for about 15 years. So we just took over and started right away a transition to organic. So we did 3 years of certification or of transition to organic, then 4 or 5 years of organic, and then organic but not certified, to finally end up where in 2007 we started the uphill climb, finally out of the valley, and started our way back up to replanting in a permaculture-inspired design.
Okay. And now when you were running the orchard as organic, what type of trees did you run there?
It was all just apples. We had 12 cultivars of commercial apples, and it was all new. It was all something that I had never done before, so it was a steep learning curve to learn organics, to learn maintaining an orchard, to learn all of that. It was a lot to learn. I took on maybe too big of a bite right from the start, but that's, to me, it's just the best way to do something is just jump in with both feet, and that's what we did.
Okay, excellent. I agree with that. Just jump in with both feet. Now, when you transitioned it from basically a commercial monoculture operation to your organic orchard, did you add any cultivars at that time, or was that what was in place?
No, that's all that was. We just took over, basically. It was a operating, fully productive orchard, so we just tried to continue that. Unfortunately, we didn't realize that the year we bought at the end of harvest so that the previous owner could finish his harvest, so that was fine. And we had the next 2 years, which was the winter of 92-93, and then 93-94 were the two coldest winters of the previous 35 years.
Wow.
And on average in Quebec, which is where we live, province-wide, we had a 25% mortality of apple trees after those two winters. And so ours was no exception. We lost about 1,000 out of 4,000 trees. So it was a bit of a tough way to start, but it helped clear the way for some of the... Basically, we had complete rows, which had virtually nothing left, and what was left, we just cut them out. So we had areas of the orchard that were starting to be open, so that was a little bit nice for a change because it gave us areas. That's where we restarted the nursery eventually and so on. So, you have to look at any bad thing and look at what could be the bright side. If you just look at it as a negative, you can live in the negative where you can look at... There's no such thing as a negative thing, totally negative. There's got to be a bright side to everything, regardless of how long it takes to see the bright side. But look for it, and you'll be surprised, but you will find the bright side to it.
Absolutely. I think that what you just defined is when there is a problem, there is also an opportunity right there. So that's excellent. So can you tell us what motivated you to make the change from an organic orchard to a permaculture system?
As much as, we had one of the largest organic orchards in the province, and as much as that seems, wow, and people would come by, and this is wonderful, but I didn't see it as all that wonderful, primarily because by then I had realized that it was still a monoculture. It was the same as my neighbor's cornfield, whatever. It was just one crop. One species, maybe even a few cultivars, but it was still one species end to end. So that was really not a good pattern to set up when you're interested in biodiversity like I was. And so that was the main thing. I realized it was still a monoculture. It had to be changed. It had to be made more diverse. And that's what really the impetus was, looking to restarted in a far more diverse. By then I had learned about permaculture. I was teaching permaculture for quite a few years since then. And it's one thing to teach something, but it comes to a point where you realize, okay, you gotta practice what you preach. So it was time to actually have an orchard that is replanted using principles of permaculture.
Excellent. Okay, so practicing what you preached and what you were teaching, in practical terms, what does that look like? So what did you do?
We really tore out what we had as the orchard, which ended up, I learned 3 years later, was not the best way to go. We could have kept, even redesigning it and replanting it in high diversity, we could have kept as much as a third of our existing orchard and simply overgrafted, which would be cut the tree down, but don't tear it up, leave the root, because we had all these trees that had good roots that we didn't take advantage of. Instead, we tore them right out.
Gotcha. So you would, in essence, what you're saying you should have done is use that as the rootstock, or at least a third of it as rootstock.
Exactly.
Okay.
That would have been a simpler, much quicker results too, because we would have been taking advantage. Right now, the apples are the slowest of all of the trees in terms of their growth. They're the smallest, and they're the ones that take the longest to get going. And we could have taken advantage and had a much more even growth of trees across the orchard. But that's why we did the film, and that's why we put out the videos and the tours and so on, to help people learn that, look, learn from our mistakes. Don't repeat the mistakes we did, and save yourself years and thousands of dollars of cost. So the film has helped a lot, giving people, and we show what's involved with an overgraft and so on. So
excellent. That's it has been very helpful for me. I've really enjoyed so far from what I've been able to see, and I know I need to sit down and dig into it deeper and watch it closer, and I definitely plan on doing that. Can we talk about the time frame? I know you said basically in 2007 is when you kind of decided to make this shift. Can you talk us through the time frame on what happened since 2007 till now?
Well, when we decided to make the shift was quite a few years before that, because we actually set up a nursery. We started a nursery to grow our own trees rather than buying them, because although, you know, that ends up being the biggest cost of setting up a permaculture orchard is the cost of plants. It takes thousands of plants, literally, just to do an acre. So we set up the nursery to provide us with the plants. So that happened in 2002. One of my former students decided he wanted to get into orcharding, so we partnered together that he would do most of the work for the nursery, and in exchange he worked with me for a couple of years, and so that was the start of really getting that. Then we tore out and replanted in 2007. So that was the time frame in terms of getting it established.
Okay. All right. And so now how many acres do you have established right now?
There's about four and a half acres replanted. We replanted three times, one plus acres each time.
Okay. Wow. Do you have any plans for expansion?
Oh, yeah. Well, we have 10 acres available out of 12. Our farm is 12, and so we have part of it rented for vegetables. We'll have part of it to be eventually a bioshelter building that we want to build. So that area is allotted for that. But in terms of the orchard that was, some of it is now just pasture. Some of it is still a little bit of the old organic orchard, so we still have remnant remaining that is gradually, as the trees die, we're not replacing them, we're just leaving them die out. So we have areas to replant already, and we're just, we'll probably be replanting the next round from seedling rather than from trees, just to try. Our next project would be to be able to establish the equivalent of the permaculture orchard at a rate of about a half an acre a day, which means planting roughly 4,000 plants a day. And so trying to work that out, how was the best way to do that? Because the way I even describe in the film, I wouldn't do it again, although it's described and it's there. And it's the only way to do it if you've got trees established, which is what we had. We had trees already planted.
Right.
And then we went in and put the plastic and did the infrastructure around the trees. But in order to start from scratch, which is another way to do it, we would go with mechanized systems to lay down the mulch, the plastic mulch and the drip tape, and then come in and plant from seed. So actually seeding or transplanting very small trees.
Okay. All right. That's great. You know, one of the things that really struck me from looking at your work is that you struck a really good balance between diversity and efficiency. Could you talk a little bit about that with your rows and those types of things?
Yeah, I guess I was the right person to do it in a way, because we had started with a very efficient orchard. It was all laid out by cultivars, which is what, when you say orchard, usually we'll think of one species laid out in rows, and so that's the image of most people have of an orchard. We didn't stray from that. Actually, we used the exact same orientation, the same row placement when we replanted the permaculture orchard. But what we did do is we used the idea of what was there before to make it efficient, which was when you harvest by date. So if you had one cultivar and it was harvested, say, the 20th of September, well, you had two, three, or four rows to be harvested within a 3 or 4 day window in those rows. So that was nice, and that was efficient, and that worked well. So I wanted to keep that same efficiency, because when it came to harvest, it makes a lot of sense. And whether it's harvested, that you do your own harvesting or you have it harvested by people who come and pick like we do, it still made a lot of sense. So right. How can you have that huge diversity, and we have a lot of diversity, you can have a lot less, which is what we'll do in the future. We will just have a lot less, but we used it as a test place to test as many different cultivars as we could. And so to keep that, to make it efficient, we used that same idea, and we just said, all right, how about dividing a month into 3 10-day windows, and it's what we call the grocery store concept. Okay. And just like you would walk down a grocery store aisle, it's the same thing. You walk down the aisle in the orchard on a certain date. So if it's the 20th of September again, and you decide to come pick, then you walk down the row that's mid-September, because it would be the 10-day window. So you'd have the 1st to the 10th, the 11th to the 21st, and the 22nd to the end of the month, say. So that's kind of the openings for the windows. And so you'd walk down the appropriate row and you harvest. So it might be you'll have plums still at that date. You'll have apples. You'll have pears. So all those three would be available then. And okay. As well, then we do all the associated ones, which would be the vines. So there would be grapes available by then. And so grapes would be ready as well in the nitrogen fixers. And you would have the ground covers. So at that time in September, there would be some late strawberries, which would be ever-bearing. You would have a whole range of herbs. So in that same row, it's just like, and that's why we call it a grocery store concept, you would walk down the grocery store aisle in the orchard and with your cart, and you would just pick. And it's always nice to see people being caught up with impulse items, which are totally healthy.
Yes, absolutely.
They're walking for one thing, and they're thinking, well, we're going to go pick apples. And then they go, oh, my God, there's these plums. And
yeah,
we encourage people to try them, and we actually have baskets when people come that they can try kind of what's available that day. And if they try, oh, my God, I got to get some of these. And so it's basically the idea. Same idea as if you go to a grocery store and you have places where you get kind of caught up with the impulse. Well, we try to do that. We try to create areas that would attract people in some way. And they eat something that's so healthy.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, you mentioned diversity a few times. Can you give us a sampling? I know you can't obviously name everything you have going there, but can you give us a sampling of the diversity that you have?
Well, just in the fruit trees, we have apples, pears, plums. We have a little bit of peaches. We have just a few peach trees left. We have hazelnuts are there. And then we have oaks that aren't bearing yet. We have chestnut. We have Japanese walnuts.
So you have a whole host of things.
The whole host of the trees, yeah, we have. And then in the shrubs, there's gooseberry currants, blackberries, black raspberries, red raspberries. We consider them shrubs just because they take the same size. We have rhubarb. I said red currant, black currant. Chemerizie, which is has caps. We have Saskatoon berries, and there's probably others that I just
right
at the top. Yeah, so there's a range, and that's just the trees and shrubs, which is actually the smallest number of species. Then you get the ground covers.
Right.
So the ground covers is, we have our top 15 that we're trying to propagate more because we find they're really great, like sea kale, like a non-flowering Ose, what's Ose in English? Sorrel, a great tasting sorrel for salads. We have perennial arugula, chives, garlic chives, bunching onions, perennial scallions, Egyptian onions. What's the other one? Asparagus, and a host of other ones that depending on the season that they're coming in, as well as herbs and cut flowers. And so the idea is we try to have something free every time we're open. It could be chives, it could be garlic chives, some of the herbs, mint or thyme, and it could be cut flowers when there's a whole lot of flowers, then people can just come pick a bouquet for themselves. If it's a huge abundance of tree fruit, like last year we had just tremendous, when we, in the film and in the videos, for those who found the, there's two videos as well, it's easy to say that there is just incredible abundance, because last year we were just totally swamped with the abundance of fruit. So we had so much, and we didn't have enough members at the start of the year. So we just offered people who were members to come pick 160 pounds of apples. Most people were totally intimidated by that.
Wow.
later, we actually did the same offer three times in the season. But by the end of the season, we were saying that come pick 40 pounds free, because we realized more people came when we offered less, when we said there's less, than when we said 160. Because for most people, they said, well, what am I going to, I can't, I, that's a problem, 160 pounds. I can't do anything with 160.
Right.
So,
you got to couple that with a workshop on food preservation.
Yeah, that would have been a must, because most people, I remember somebody, they had come back and they were like, wow, that's a lot of apples. I said, well, that's good. Now you can just bring that to your car and go back and get your second half. And they looked at me like, second half? Like, I don't know what I'm going to do with these. I said, yeah, but you only got two bushels. That's 80 pounds. You still have two more bushels to go get. Wow. And they never did. It was like, no, that just scared them totally.
Yeah, I can imagine. That would be intimidating, especially if you're, haven't thought about doing some canning or maybe some dehydration, things like that.
Right. People took advantage of it, certainly stored up a winter supply of fruit, so that was good.
That's awesome. That's really cool. Hey, have you done any analysis as far as production is concerned, like comparing your organic orchard to this new permaculture system as far as, you know, per square foot or per, you know, anything like that, any type of analysis as far as production?
Well, we haven't gotten it that precise yet. We have got looks or an idea of places that we'd say, well, okay, these trees are on a tree basis, for example. Our trees can produce two bushels, which would be 80 pounds to sometimes some of the trees will be 120 pounds per a fruit per tree. And so we also looked at our shrubs, so some of the shrubs, how much they can produce. And then when we look at the herbs, so if we take the example of the design, which is a trio, so that's three trees, two fruit trees and a nitrogen fixer.
Right.
And then with each tree, we associate one to four shrubs. But even if you just start with one shrub per tree, so you have the tree, you have the shrub, and then each tree is associated with 16 perennials, two rows of eight plants. And so once you put those together, combined with the vine that's growing on the nitrogen fixer, combined with the fowl that'll graze in the rows, grazing the grass and remove pens through the lanes, if you do all that together, it's the total. We don't look at it as per unit as much anymore. We just look at it as the per unit, per total. We know that the potential is there because we haven't got everything planted at that density yet, because it really does take quite a staggering amount of plants to fill, because now you're no longer looking as when it was the organic orchard, which all you had was grass and a tree.
Right.
So that was the look, and that was what we were aiming to get. So in that time, we raised sheep, we raised turkey, we raised poultry under the trees. And so we still had two or three or four crops that we could get from the orchard. But our vegetative harvest was the trees and grass. That was it. So now we got a lot more crops. And we know that having done the projections, the potential is definitely there to gross $1 per square foot.
Great.
So that's our next target, is to be able to fill the orchard, plant it completely, so that it'll have that density needed to be able to gross that amount.
Great. Okay. Just a quick question. What nitrogen-fixing trees do you use for support species?
Probably the same ones you could use. We have used the main one, as it's in the film, is the honey locust, which okay. turns out not to be the best nitrogen fixer. It's a great tree. It's not the best one. It does fix, and because we prune it, it fixes a little more nitrogen because it basically sloughs off roots when you prune it, and that's where the nitrogen is freed up. But that's one. We have black locust as well, which is great. It's a better nitrogen fixer. The only thing is, because we run a system where people come and you pick and the tours, it's a far more dangerous tree because of the thorns. And okay. so we consider safety to be a point in the design of the orchard. So the black locust is definitely not the safest tree to be around. We also use Russian olive, which is good. We use seaberry. It's more in the shrub. We use seaberry as one. We use carragana, hippophay. What's the other one? Eleagnus commutata, which is silverberry, I think it's called, or buffalo berry. So we use those. We use every one that can grow in our climate, except for the alders. The alders we haven't put in, mainly because we're totally in a sandy site. So,
okay, all right. And you mentioned in the documentary is the talking about the U pick. Are there any other methods of marketing that you use, like direct marketing or to your consumers?
Well, we use direct. That's what we use, and it's direct whether they come or people driving by. Like when we have too much for the members, we do pick, and we put that available for sale by the roadside. We have an honor system that we just have fill up the bushels, and people pick whatever, a bag or a bushel or a basket, and they just leave the amount in the can, and that's all there is. So we still believe there's honor to be had, and people do like that. And if you trust people, you know, what you sow, you will reap. So we sow trust, that we trust people, and we get it in return.
Very good. Awesome. Hey, I was watching this morning, actually, with Jeff Lawton was talking with Mark Shepard on one of his videos. And I wanted to ask you the same question he asked him. And it was, is a permaculture system viable and profitable?
Yeah, I just watched that about 20 minutes before we got on. It's a great video. Certainly recommend anybody to look at that. And it really could be profitable, mainly because you don't need the huge levels of production that is aimed for in even conventional or certainly even in organic. You don't need that level of production to be profitable because your costs are so far down from what those systems do, because don't forget, they're an input system. You have all these inputs in fertilizer and herbicides and insecticides. You think organic does well. Yeah, organic, you can use vinegar, you can use other things to get your weeds or your grasses, keep them down. And they do, they use inputs to, and I mean, I've seen it, I was organic, and it could be a lot of inputs. So right. if you want to get the level of production they get, you need a level of inputs that's far higher. But the thing is, with the way Mark is doing it or I'm doing it, you just have so much less of a cost per unit. So even if you produce a half of what they do, you still can be profitable because your costs are way down.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, and one that I definitely wanted to bring out, because I know that you're doing it. Your inputs are far lower than I'm sure even when you were the organic orchard. So that's a wonderful thing. Can you tell us kind of what led up to the documentary?
It's something that was on the back burner for a while. It just like I said, we replanted in 2007. We didn't say anything for, I'd say, 3 years. We just watched it grow. It hadn't really started to produce until around 2010. And then seeing how it started and how it got going and how the system, I really liked when Mark said that the ornithologist said that there was no place he had seen that as many birds. That's in the springtime, that's everybody's reaction is, my God, you have so many birds here. It's absolutely ridiculous. Like, I was listening to, I was recording something at the farm one day, and just the background, I mean, I listened to the birds, but it's because I'd recorded it, and all I was hearing were these birds singing in the background. I thought, my gosh, it's nonstop. There's a bird every 3 seconds saying something in the background. So it is. There's tremendous diversity of wildlife, just in the birds, but also in other species. But they are all part of the whole allied picture. And so one of the reasons why to do the film was I wanted to, first of all, be sure that it worked. So I did wait. And then Olivier Asselin, the filmmaker, he came to do a little video for his possiblemedia.org. You go see that site, possiblemedia.org.
Okay.
He's got a whole series of great videos there showing what's possible. And it's really inspiring. And so he had heard about the orchard and he came to get a look. And when he came, I described to him afterwards what I would like to do. And he said, sure, let's do it. And so we worked it together to put the film up, and he did the majority of the work. We shot for 10 days and got it together. So it's the idea being that it describes the steps involved in setting up, in maintaining such a planting. And from the comments, anyway, I think it really hit on a very timely nerve. People wanted that information, and he did such a fantastic job of making a film with the word permaculture in it to be so high quality. That was really the key. He put such pains into getting everything tweaked, and the sound and the graphics and everything to make it really pleasant. And I saw the iterations of the film, and when I knew nothing about films and that. And when the first one came, I could say it was really a rough cut. He said, this is just a rough cut, and it was rough. So okay. It's interesting to see that you can have the same footage, but how you put it together, how you edit it, how you assemble it with sound and graphics and everything else, it can really make a far more interesting piece. And so it was nice to see that permaculture has something that is really of that good a quality. I like Jeff's videos as well. It's I think it's Frank Grabinski who does his videos, and he also puts a lot of care into making the videos really catchy and really high quality, which it's time. I mean, it's enough of just holding a cell phone and taking a selfie video of yourself. I mean, people have done that, and that's good. You get information out. And it's a great way to start, but it really is time that we ratchet it to the next level with the quality of what's put out.
Absolutely, and I got to say, it was very well done. The documentary is very well done. It's really, it was a joy to watch, actually. You know, it reminded me, though, when you were talking about something you said in the documentary, and it had to do with sharing of the surplus, and you were talking about the animals and the birds and the insects eating some of the fruit, and you had said something to the effect that, hey, they're working day and night. That really struck me. It was an excellent line.
Well, it's true. I guess it's because my wildlife background, I studied as an ornithologist, and then I did a master's in animal behavior. So, I mean, I've sat and watched hundreds and hundreds of hours of observing through a telescope and so on. And so I've seen the fine details of what wildlife do, and that kind of attention, people really rarely put that amount of effort into seeing what's really going on. And it opened my eyes to, wow, they're doing so many things that save us tremendous amount of work otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely.
When you see that, you realize, wow, why don't we take advantage of it? Why aren't we attracting them? And it's so easy, because all you need is to give them a home. As soon as the home is there, they're going to move in if the habitat's right. So to give you an example, when we first, the first year when we bought the farm, even if it was still from conventional, in the spring I saw all these tree swallows flying around, because an orchard is an insect-rich area traditionally. It's always been one of the most rich and diverse habitats for wildlife. And so I saw all these swallows, and I thought, wow, all they need is a home. Everything else is there. So we put together a bunch of nest boxes, put them up, and the first two that I put up, I was putting in two separate lanes, one post, let's say the first post on two separate lanes. So these trees were 12 feet apart. I put the first post, put a nest box up on it, screwed it into the post, got down the ladder, put the ladder to the second one. I was going up the ladder, and by the time I got to the top of the second post, 12 feet away, two swallows had moved in, looked, checking out the site. They're calling to each other, "So, dear, what do you think? I think it's good. Okay, it's sold."
Wow.
It took all of a minute and a half, and they had taken the site, basically. So that shows how when it is right, when the habitat is right, all you need is to give them, I called it it's the limiting factor. What is limiting? What's keeping the area from attracting more of everything, whether it's hummingbirds or whether it's birds or whether it's snakes? What are they lacking? And once you know that, what they could be lacking, whether it's food, cover, or water mainly, then just give them that and they'll come. So they'll find the area and they'll use it.
Yeah, absolutely. And in turn, that just balances out the whole system.
Just to give you the kind of the follow-up to that and how well it's worked, people spend a lot of time, effort, and money controlling caterpillars in orchards, because caterpillars love apple leaves, and some of them love the fruit as well. And so a lot of effort is spent on controlling caterpillars. Well, the last 2 years we've seen, now that the orchard has matured and the trees have reached full size and maturity, the diversity of plantings as well has matured. The last 2 years we haven't had a single tree that I consider damaged. We've had a lot of caterpillars, and we've had a lot of starts of caterpillars, I should say, where they were, eggs were laid and the caterpillars hatched. But as opposed to when it was organic and I would have a half of the tree eaten, and the worst year was out of 3,000 trees, I had 1,000 trees eaten halfway.
Wow.
And that's pretty discouraging when you walk through and you realize, okay, there's just far more than I used to remove them by hand. There was no way.
Right.
Physically, it was not possible to take all those nests off, because often there was two or three in a tree. And so that was what I remembered it could be, or how bad the damage could be. And the last 2 years, we've seen lots of those caterpillars started, and not once did they actually go beyond the first branch. And most of them were dead before they reached halfway down the first branch. So as opposed to getting half the tree would be usually 7 to 10 branches, now they would not even eat half of one branch for the most part.
Wow, that's incredible.
It shows that without doing anything, I mean, I'm not doing anything to control them other than creating habitat primarily for birds in the spring and wasps in the fall, summer and fall. So those two groups take care of the caterpillars for me. So when I say day and night, I mean, it's from dawn to dusk in those two species, and then the bats take over for the nighttime caterpillar, the nighttime moths who would lay eggs. So that's great to have them do the work for me.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really a great example. So, you know, from your documentary, The Permaculture Orchard, that's led to quite a bit of attention for you, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Yeah.
You've been busy.
I've been very busy, yes.
Can you tell us some of the things that you're doing?
Well, certainly just a lot more presentations, a lot more interviews, whether it's Permaculture Voices, Survival Podcast, I've been on them a few times each, newspaper, TV, radio. I try to make the message to show to people that, look, it's not about me or my farm. It's what we could have as a society. Here's what could be done. Like, look at this. And now, is it impossible for you to have just one small part of it in your backyard to make people realize, hey, what if you just plant two trios? That's always my goal. Just start with two trios. I mean, six trees. And put the associated plants under and start attracting birds. And don't kill the wasps that nest in your yard and so on and so on. And to me, that's the message that I want to get out, because my personal mission for the farm is that there would be 1,000 hectares, which is 2,200 acres, not for me to have, but that there would be planted in 50 countries by 1,000 people. So once that goal is reached, I'm going to erase myself from the picture and move on to my other missions. But right now, that's the main focus, is to get that out. I've got a book coming out that has to be finished for Permaculture Voices 2. So that's in March. And that's just ways of making the message go forward. That video, like you mentioned, mentioned Mark's work, that's great. I mean, people have to get exposed to that. We realize how there's such a huge piece of pie out there that hasn't even been explored. Imagine if you put a piece of pie down, a pie, and you tried to take a 1/100th sliver out of that pie. Right. Well, that's how many people have been really exposed to permaculture. It's less than 1%.
Yeah.
Just for those of us who are involved in it, if we just get to 3% or 5%, heaven forbid, I mean, we're going to be so swamped with work, we won't know what to do. So we need to crank up systems. We need to crank up information. We need to certainly train up a whole lot more people who will be ready to show what they've done and share that. This is what's possible. We don't have to go to a monoculture model anymore. We don't have to rely on the chemical companies as if they are the only way to grow food, which they're not. We can do things in a far more holistic, but it requires information. It's basically the difference being that the permaculture model is an information-rich model. And Mollison said it right, that the only limit to the system is the creativity of the designer. So how many more elements, how many more parts can you add in? That's what will determine how productive your system is. We haven't even explored. I mean, we've looked at it and we're aware of it, but we haven't applied the whole fungal layer in our orchard yet. So we could produce probably as much value just from mushrooms, yeah, as we do from all the rest. And so there's so many parts. It's almost like, wow, where do we start just to add in all the things that we still can do?
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. Now, you mentioned earlier that you integrated animals into the system. Could you cover that real quick once again?
We run pens. It's like you imagine
moving paddocks.
Our orchard. We do have parts, because we have parts of the orchard that are, so we do graze them in some of the pasture areas, but we also try to integrate them right into the orchard in the row. And so they're just raised in these mobile pens. And depending on the species, if we use laying hens, we don't even have to have them fenced with electric fencing, which is a lot nicer, because all we do is move a pen and then they'll come back every night and they'll go out in the morning. Otherwise, if it's things like chickens, turkeys are nice too, because we actually don't give them anything other than a roost. So we move their roost, and anywhere we see that the orchard has a weaker soil, and we just put the roost above the weak soil areas. We haven't done turkeys for a few years, but that was great to, when we were planting, we were just using them as a mobile fertilizer applicator, because they would graze throughout the orchard. And even sometimes they'd hop the fence and go to the neighbors, but they'd always come back in the evening. So they would come back to roost. They were very faithful, and they are very faithful. And that's where, you know, the animals, you have to spend the time to learn about each one of them. In fact, we've already got it scheduled next year to follow up for the first film. We are doing a film next year on starting your own nursery, because the biggest cost is the plants. So showing how to start your nursery, how to multiply every single kind of plant that you would need for the permaculture orchard. So people would be well equipped to start right where they are, whether it's right on a gallery, whether they have a tiny backyard, whatever. Wherever you are, you could start. You could start something. You can start some seeds in trays. You can start some cuttings in a bag. You can start a whole bunch of different ways. So we're going to show all those ways people can multiply plants, because once you have a collection of, whether it's 50 or 500 or 5,000 plants, you have a very strong motivator to get your project in gear and find some place to actually plant them. Because you can't leave a tree sitting there for 5 years and then decide to come back and pull it up. It won't just pull up after five.
Right. Right. Well, that's great. I'm really looking forward to seeing that as well. That's something that we definitely want to implement here as well, or simply will help us to do it in a more cost-effective manner, what we're trying to do. You know, earlier you mentioned basically about the backyard gardener, or anybody who could plant these two trios. Do you have any advice for the homesteader, or the person who's kind of looking for that in-between area? Maybe they want to do a little bit more than the two trios, but how do they start?
They can start as simply as putting in or using what's there, really. I would say use what's there. So find out on your site what wants to grow on its own. What is there that can almost become a weed on its own? They're a good indicator. For example, you might have wild grapes growing crazy. Well, that's a great indicator that your site is very appropriate to growing cultivated grapes. Maybe you have cherry trees growing, wild cherries going everywhere. Well, then you can grow the cultivated sweet cherries, or maybe sweet cherries, and most likely sour cherries, or some of the new hardy cherry cultivars from Saskatchewan. It could be that you've got all kinds of nut trees just coming up on their own. Well, if you've got nut trees growing, then it's convenient to nut trees. So before you even plant anyone, make sure you know what can grow in your area. I was just talking with a client consulting on someone from Utah, and he's got a lot of area, and he wanted to put fruit, and it would cost him a lot to put in water systems. And then just looking from Google Earth, I said, are all those trees in the hills, is that all pine trees? I said, yeah. Well, I said, why don't you grow pine nuts? I mean, pine trees are growing everywhere. They're all around you. So why not put in pine trees and harvest them mechanically? Because there are mechanical tree shakers that will harvest some of those things. So because it's on a large scale and water would be very expensive, that became a very attractive possibility. And he used to sell pine nuts as a kid, so he said, wow, that would really close the loop from what he's familiar with. And so it's just that, take a time to look around. Just look in the neighborhood, look in the ditches, look around what grows well, and start considering the cultivated equivalent of that. Because it's always easier to choose the right plant for the site than to make the site right for the plant. It just seems like a play on words. But it's hard to change the site to make it convenient to the plant that you want to grow. It's far easier to grow a plant that just wants to grow there anyway.
Absolutely. That's great advice. Otherwise, if you're trying to do the opposite, you've got to add inputs.
Or do a lot of groundwork. Might be drainage. It might be heat retention. It might be waterworks are always great and doing swaling and so on, but is there a way to start that's even easier? So it's looking around and work with the site is always the best.
Well, that's, I tell you what, that's a great place to finish up right there. I want to thank you. The amount of information that you provided for us is excellent. We look forward to more of your work. And if people want to learn more about what you're doing or what you've done up to this point, how can they learn more?
I'll certainly start off with the film site. So that's permacultureorchard.com. And it's a film that's available in both French and English. And it's in 11 languages now, actually translated. So pretty well anybody, even non-English, will find a version that suits them, because it's pretty well every main temperate climate language we've got. So permacultureorchard.com is that one. Our farm site is miracle.farm. So that's a UTLD.farm. Anybody who has a farm, I recommend that you look into getting your farm name as a .farm, because otherwise you'll pay a lot to try to get the .com equivalent. And start with those. You'll have a lot of fun. There's a series of videos that there's some videos out there that describe. So go to possiblemedia.org. There's a few of the videos are there.
Okay, great. Well, once again, thank you very much. I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk with us here.
You're welcome, Sean. Hope you have a great success on your podcast series.
Thank you very much. Our scripture reading today comes from Proverbs chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. Honor the Lord with your wealth and with the first fruits of all your produce. Then your barns will be filled with plenty, and your vats will be bursting with wine. This concludes today's podcast. Thanks for listening. Please visit us on our website, thecourageouslifepodcast.com. We'd appreciate any comments or questions that you have. And also like us on Facebook, The Courageous Life Podcast. Semper Fidelis and Soli Deo Gloria.